1 Samuel chapter 14. In chapter 13, Saul's son Jonathan attacked a garrison of the Philistines in Geba. Jonathan had command of only 1,000 soldiers, so we assume that that garrison was much fewer in number. It was an easy victory for Jonathan and his 1,000 men, but actions have consequences, especially when it comes to battle. And what ends up happening is that the Philistine loss has agitated the entire force of the Philistines. They have mustered all of their forces, and they are now marching toward Israel for the purpose of engaging Israel in battle. We read in chapter 13, verse 5, that the Philistines mustered 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and troops like the sand on the seashore in multitude. And then on the other side, you have the Philistines, where only Saul and Jonathan have swords. We were told that at the end of chapter 13. Those are the only two guys in the whole nation that have, like, legitimate weapons. And the rest of the nation, well, it's an army of farmers. They're out there swinging hoes and pickaxes and mattocks and any kind of farm implement that they could get sharp enough to swing at another soldier and harm them. So this is, you know, unbelievable odds. This is like Costa Rica getting mad at the U.S. and trying to attack and overcome the U.S. This is like slingshots against machine guns. The odds are most certainly stacked against the Israelites here when you leave the Lord out of the equation. And then in verse 23, this massive, well-armed Philistine army comes to the pass of Michmash to encamp there. And on the other side of that pass, that passageway between these two elevated mountain ranges of sorts, is the humble army, the farmer army of the nation of Israel. And they're staring at each other from across this pass of Michmash. And they all know what's coming. They know what's about to happen. It's just a matter of who flinches first, who makes the first move, who does the first thing and gets this thing going. So that's where we are as we come to chapter 14, verse 1. And let's begin reading in verse 1. It says, "One day Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who carried his armor, 'Come, let us go over to the Philistine garrison on the other side.' But he did not tell his father." So this is now the second time that Jonathan has done something like this. He made an executive decision to attack a garrison of the Philistines back in chapter 13. We just mentioned it in the introduction. And from everything that we could tell, his father didn't know about that either. It certainly didn't seem to be the order. That was just an executive decision by Jonathan, so it would seem. And here he goes again. Another executive decision that will ultimately, you know, lead to another battle and put them in another situation of danger. And I tell you, this guy, Jonathan, this guy was scrappy. And even better yet, He wasn't just a good fighter, a courageous guy, a valiant warrior, but he was a man who deeply loved the Lord from his heart and had great faith in God. That's like the great lesson that we're going to get in this chapter. It's like really a masterclass on faith. There's a reason why in the book of Hebrews, the Hall of Faith, chapter 11, they reach back and grab stories like this. Because you can go down through this chapter and the story about Jonathan and you can just pick up all of these nuggets of truth to teach you about faith. So I want to encourage you just to really listen in to the faith of Jonathan. And I'll do my best to pull out, to extract some of those lessons about faith for you. But if you'll really hear this, if you'll really listen to this, if you'll really apply this, this is a masterclass on how you as a Christian should direct your faith and what you should be looking forward to in your faith as a believer. It really makes you wonder how it was possible that Saul raised this guy, Jonathan. I mean, they're like night and day, oil and water. They're completely different. Somehow, this guy, Jonathan, with great courage and tremendous faith in God, somehow he comes from Saul. You know, usually it's that the kids don't turn out as well as the parents. You got that just constant downhill through the generations. But every now and then, every once in a while, the kids turn out to be these incredible men and women of God, and the parents didn't even really try. Kind of makes me mad, because I tried so hard to raise mighty men and women of faith, mighty men and a woman of faith from my family. And man, I just feel like some people don't even try and do better than I did. But I did my best. My kids are what they are. And I thank the Lord for them and for the faith that they do have. But humanly speaking, yeah, Jonathan was an amazing guy. He was able to view his circumstances according to the greatness of his God, whereas most people would view their God according to the greatness of their circumstances. You know what I mean? That's where our view of God teeters and totters and goes up and down depending on what we're going through and whether it's easy or difficult. If it's an easy challenge, an easy battle, then we're like, yes, this is great. God is awesome. God can handle this. I believe. But then when things are difficult and the battles are tough, we're like, oh boy, I'm sweating bullets here. Lord, I don't know if you're going to be able to pull this out. I don't know if you're going to be able to pull this off. I don't know if we can do this, Lord. I just am struggling with my faith. Jonathan was the opposite of that. He didn't view God based on the challenge of what he was going through. He just viewed everything else in his world on the bigness and the greatness of his God. So Jonathan is just going to go for it here. And again, he doesn't want his father to know, because I would suspect that if his father found out what Jonathan was intending here, he would say, absolutely not. No way. You are not going to do this to me again. You did this last time and we got lucky. It worked out. We got a victory. But don't you dare do this again and put us in this kind of situation. Now, that is just speculation, of course, but I can't imagine my speculation is all that far off. Because if we just look at the next verse, we get to find out where Saul is on this whole thing. We know where Jonathan is. He's up and raring to go. He's ready to fight. Where is Saul on this? Well, here's where Saul is. He has the same information Jonathan does. He's looking at the same army that Jonathan is. But here's where Saul is. Verse 2. Saul was staying on the outskirts of Gibeah in the pomegranate cave at Migron. Now, some translations say that that was under a pomegranate tree. And that's just the difference between older and more recent manuscripts. I tend to be completely in favor of the older manuscripts, as you know, that date back to the closer to the time of these writings. So I'll just stick with that as my subject for teaching. I'm going to teach this as a cave that is easily identified by the pomegranate trees that are situated around it. And it says that's where Saul is. And rest of verse 2, the people who were with him were about 600 men. So where is Saul and what he was doing? Well, my best guess is that he was hiding and cowering in a cave with his 600 men. He has called back in chapter 13 the bulk of Israel's army. They have not shown up yet. Saul is still there with just his 600 men. And it would appear to me Saul and his men are not coming out of the cave until the rest of the Israeli army arrives. What else would they be doing in the cave, right? Vacationing? No, I don't think so. Working on their cave paintings? I don't think so. I think they're in their hiding. I think they're in their cowering. And verse 3 says, there was someone else with Saul and his 600. It says, including Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, which is definitely tougher to get into than a low tub, especially when you get old. Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, son of Phinehas, son of Eli, the priest of the Lord in Shiloh, wearing an ephod. So all of that basically just to say to us that Saul has got Ahijah, the priest, with him, in that cave. Verse 4. Reading on in verse 3. And the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. So tuck that feather away in your cap for a little bit later on. That's going to come into play as the story unfolds. No one recognized Jonathan and his armor bearers skedaddling out of the cave there and leaving. Verse 4. Within the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistine garrison, there was a rocky crag on the one side and a rocky crag on the other side. The name of the one was Bozez, which means the shining. There's probably a joke in there, but I'm not worried about it. Bozez means the shining. And the name of the other, Sena, which means thorny rock, verse 5. The one crag rose on the north in front of Michmash, which means something hidden. And the other on the south in front of Geba, and Geba means the hill. So there's all your meanings there. And this is a very descriptive location for us. And I just want to let you know, they do have a positive ID on this location over there in Israel today. And if you go on a tour over there, they can take you right to this spot. You can flip open this passage and say, yeah, this has got to be it. I mean, like the way that this is so thoroughly described, and as unique of a topographical formation as all of this is pretty easy to identify over there. The Lord made sure, I think, to preserve the location of this battlefield forever. And you're going to see why. It was a tremendous victory marked by great faith. Verse 6. Jonathan said to the young man who carried his armor, come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. He says, listen, these are heathens. They don't know God. We do. They're not in a covenant with God. We are. We are God's people. What are we concerned about? What are we worried about from these heathens? Let's just go for this. And it says, it may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few. That was a verse that we referenced, I believe, in chapter 13 when I was teaching through that. That final statement of verse 6, that should probably get underlined or highlighted in your Bible, and you might want to work on memorizing that line. I think it would be good for your Christianity if you did. Saul and his 600 men are likely cowering and hiding out in a cave waiting for backup. Jonathan has just one guy with him, and yet he is ready to step out in faith and test the waters and see what the Lord might want to do in their situation. You know, just check it out. See if the Lord might want to use them in some kind of miraculous way. Now, to be thorough, I would like to add that an armor bearer is not merely the guy that helped the soldier get dressed. Like, armor bearer just didn't walk around with your armor waiting for you to go to battle. Hold on, let me get this on you. Wasn't like your golf caddy, you know, carrying your clubs around and then handing you clubs. An armor bearer was much more than that. An armor bearer was someone that was trained in battle, so they were very good in battle. And really, an armor bearer was more like that soldier's right-hand man. That was someone that, like, they just trusted to fight with and to be with them by their side in battle. So he's not just a guy carrying around Jonathan's armor, right? He's an actual soldier, and you're going to see he's very courageous as well, just as Jonathan is. But it's still crazy faith, isn't it? Like, there's only two of us. Yeah, we're both soldiers, fine. But there's only two of us. And listen, they're not going to be attacking, you know, a couple hundred thousand Philistines here. They're only attacking a garrison. This is going to be the same thing that Jonathan did in chapter 13. He's just going to see a small group of Philistine troops posted. And he's going to go and attack that little garrison, right? We're going to be told later on in this chapter there's 20. There's 20 guys in this garrison. But the point is, they're staring down the whole Philistine army. It's not just about overcoming a small garrison of Philistines. This is about, okay, we know what's going to happen if we launch out and attack this garrison. All of the Philistines are going to be after us. But I just love this, that that is not a concern in the mind of Jonathan. It's still going to be 2 verses 20. That's what they're staring down right now as Jonathan's thinking, man, we can do this. But to Jonathan and his faith is not about numbers. I love that statement. That look, if the Lord determines to do something, I don't care how many people God is working with or how few. If God determines to do something, then God is most certainly going to do it. So let me give you 3 powerful lessons about biblical faith that come directly from the faith of Jonathan depicted for us in this chapter. These would be the most important lessons to take out of this chapter. And it is crucial as a believer in Christ that you either already know and apply these lessons about faith, or if you don't, that you learn them tonight and then begin working on applying them in your life. It is absolutely crucial that your faith resemble Jonathan's. Now, it may not be to the extent of purity and quality as Jonathan's, but your faith should resemble Jonathan's faith. So first let me say that, let's just go with a very conservative number. Let's say there's, 200,000 soldiers over there. And it's probably more than that, I would guess for sure. But let's just conservatively say there's 200,000 Philistine soldiers over there. And it's just Jonathan and his armor bearer taking on 20. So in Jonathan's mind, he's placing a number value on God for this battle. Very conservatively, if we're just looking at the garrison, we would say that Jonathan feels comfortable letting God account for 18 Philistine soldiers. So, Lord, we got these 2. The other 18, they're yours. But if you want to take this and really look at the full scope of it and all of the potential repercussions of this attack from Jonathan, it's very likely that in Jonathan's mind, he's thinking this. All right, it's us 2, potentially against 200,000 Philistines. So, Lord, the numeric soldier value that I place on you when you're engaged in warfare for us is 198,000. He's like putting a value on just how big he believes that the Lord is here. Now, I don't know if it's true or not, but there is a legend regarding Peter the Great, who was the Tsar of Russia in the early 1700s. On one occasion, one of his generals messaged to him and said, I need a certain amount of soldiers. I am up against it. I need reinforcements. Send me this number of soldiers. And the story goes that Peter the Great did not have the full number of soldiers available to him. That was requested by his general. So he sent him a number of reinforcements, but he sent him 50,000 less soldiers than what his general asked for. And when his general sent word back, hey, where's the other 50,000 soldiers that I requested? It is said that Peter the Great sent word back to him and said, oh, I have accounted you as the 50,000. And I don't know if that story is true or not. That's putting a value of confidence on a person. That's the same thing that Jonathan is doing with the Lord here. So let's let the rubber hit the road here. Let's let this get a little bit close to the vest and ask the question, does that put our faith to shame? Yes, it does. I'll answer for all of you. Yes, it does. I have never known a quality of faith like this. My faith has never been this great. And I would feel very good guessing for you that your faith has never been this strong either. Because more often than not, we're struggling with even the little things, to trust that God is big enough for the little things in our life. Here's Jonathan more than likely thinking, if I'm engaged by 200, 300,000 Philistine soldiers, I'm good because I got you, Lord. And then there's us saying, Lord, I don't know if you're going to be able to help me to get the electric bill paid this month. And Lord, I don't know if you're going to be able to help me find a job since I lost the old one. And Lord, I'm just stressed. And all these things in life, they're so terrible. Come on. This is a great challenge for our faith, to see faith like this being put in use in this story, in this battle. And I hope it encourages you and inspires your faith tonight. That's what these stories of the scriptures are supposed to do, aren't they? Faith comes by hearing, hearing by the word of God. This is how we build our faith right here. So faith lesson number one would be that God accounted for much in Jonathan's faith. He did not limit God's size or God's power. Honestly, if you think about Jonathan's faith here, I would say it even makes David's faith in going up against Goliath look pretty small. David was facing one giant, and you know, he had four other stones that he picked up. He picked five stones up from the brook that day. So it's very likely that he was intending on having to get into a kerfuffle, is that the right word, with Goliath's four brothers, also giants. But here's Jonathan taking on for sure 20, and once again poking the hornet's nest, not knowing what the fallout's going to be. But he's got the faith to do this. This is incredible faith. Next we have Jonathan saying, okay, let's test the waters here. Let's just slip over there before the enemy and see what happens. Let's see if the Lord will want to do something through us. I will call this testing the waters faith, just for simple ease here. Testing the waters faith. Have you had moments like that where you had testing the waters faith, where you weren't completely confident, you didn't know 100% that the Lord was going to do something? You just knew that he was most certainly capable of it if he wanted to. So you kind of stepped out, you took a chance, you prayed, you asked the Lord, and you just got into the situation to see if the Lord might do something. Have you ever done that? I think that's the majority of what my faith looks like. I have a lot of confidence that the Lord can do anything. My issue is always, but does he want to for me? So I do this a lot. This is testing the water faith. I get asked all the time to lay hands on people and pray for people. People who are sick, people who have needs. For me, that's testing the faith. For me, that's testing the water's faith. Because I'm saying, Lord, I know you can do this. I know you can heal this person. I know you can meet this need. The question is, do you want to? So I'm asking you, Lord, will you do it? The word of faith movement is very critical against that kind of faith. I would say there is absolutely no place in word of faith doctrine for this kind of faith that Jonathan is showing here. As a New Testament Christian in 2025, if you're around a word of faith movement person, you know, the name it, claim it people, the blab it, grab it folks, if you're around someone like that, And you make a statement something like this, well, I don't know if the Lord will want to do this. I know he can, but I'm going to ask him if he would. If you do something like that around folks like that, they will criticize you. They will try to, quote unquote, correct you, even though they're wrong. They will say, no, you don't talk like that to the Lord. You don't pray like that to the Lord. You don't say, Lord, if you're willing, will you do this? You just claim it. You just say, Lord, I believe you're going to do this, and because I believe you're going to do this, you have to. You're on the hook. Now, obviously, that is not biblical truth, and there are many verses and passages that teach us against that sort of thing. So to bring some sanity to that viewpoint, the word of faith's greatest sin is their absolute disregard for the will of God. When did faith and prayer and asking for things from the Lord, when did that ever become devoid of the will of God? It's always been in accord with the will of God. Anywhere you look in the scriptures, we can't just read that Jesus is our healer and assume that if we have the faith to be healed, that he has to heal us, or he's breaking his word to us. We can't hear that he is our miracle worker, that he is our problem solver, and then just take for granted that if we really truly believe in that moment that he will do it for us, that he has to do it for us. That's not how the Lord works. That's not how faith works. Faith is important, but the things we're asking from the Lord, that must always be accompanied with a regard for the will of God. Look at the three men, famously known as the three Hebrew children, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And look at their prayer, getting ready to be thrown in the fiery furnace for not bowing down. And their statement was what? Their statement was, well, we know that the Lord can deliver us. We know the Lord can handle this. But if he doesn't, then we're still not going to bow. It doesn't change our theology, even if he doesn't. It doesn't change our faith. It doesn't change our position and dedication and devotion to God. I read that as a kid. That just amazed me. Like, well, that's not very good faith. We know he can. Well, but if he doesn't? No, that is great faith. What about the leper from Mark chapter 1, verse 40, who wanted the Lord to cleanse him of leprosy? He didn't say to Jesus, you will make me clean because I have the faith. I got you. You got to do it. I believe. You're on the hook now. He didn't say that, did he? He said, if you are willing, you can make me clean. That's the same kind of testing the waters faith. So faith lesson number two, Jonathan's faith took into account God's will. He did not have a presumptuous or demanding faith, but he had a polite and humble faith. And that needs to be learned and applied by us for sure. We need to have a humble and polite faith. We need to always take into account what the will of God is for any given situation. And then thirdly, Jonathan has some biblical basis for his faith here. He's not just like out in left field on this. He actually has a reason to believe how he believes here and to think that God might want to use these two to do something absolutely astonishing. First of all, we come from Leviticus chapter 26, verse 8, where the Lord told them, and this is a promise, five of you shall chase 100, and 100 of you shall chase 10,000, and your enemies shall fall before you by the sword. So you guys are going to be able to be victorious in overwhelming odds, because I'm with you. Or how about Deuteronomy chapter 28, verse 7, the Lord said, the Lord will cause your enemies who rise up against you to be defeated before you. They shall come out against you one way and flee before you seven ways. I like that. They're going to come in one direction. I'm going to send them running in all sorts of different directions. So odds don't matter. Numbers don't matter. If you're the Lord's going to take care of you in battle. That's the faith and the groundedness, the location of where Jonathan is grounding his faith here. So faith lesson number three would be that Jonathan's faith was a biblically informed and biblically authorized faith. It was in no wise random or reckless. And you need to apply that to your own faith as well so that you aren't barking up the wrong trees in life. You never want to get into the place where you are putting faith in something that God is not in. That is a misplaced faith, and I don't think I need to tell you the risks of misplaced faith. First of all, the heartbreak. Second of all, the trauma that can cause to your faith. And then third of all, the disaster that that can cause in life. I guess I did go ahead and tell you anyway. So, here's those three lessons. Very concisely put. Go big with faith in God, take into account the will of God always, and then ground your faith to the Word of God. Good stuff, isn't it? Good lessons about faith. Verse 7, and his armor bearer said to him, do all that is in your heart, do as you wish, behold, I am with you, heart and soul. Now notice he didn't say anything about his body. He didn't say, I'm with you body, heart, and soul. Now listen, I do think it's fair that you know. If I ever tell you I'm with you heart and soul, here's what that means. That means my thoughts and my prayers are with you, but my body's going in a different direction. I won't be there. That's what I mean when I say that. But what Jonathan's armor bearer means is that absolutely he is going bodily, but more than that, he is in complete agreement with what Jonathan is wanting to do here. This guy has the same kind of faith that Jonathan does. He's ready for this. He's ready body, heart, and soul. All right, so verse 8, then Jonathan said, behold, we will cross over to the men, and we will show ourselves to them, and maybe stick our tongues out, blow some raspberries, antagonize them a little bit. Verse 9, if they say to us, wait until we come to you. Now that is to say, you guys stay right there, we're going to come over there and destroy you. If they say that, then we will stand still in our place and we will not go up to them. Verse 10, but if they say, come up to us, that is, bring it on. Come fight us. If they say that, then Jonathan says, then we will go up, for the Lord has given them into our hands, and this shall be the sign to us. So this is just wild stuff to me. I will tell you this. This is not how my faith responds to situations like this. My sign would be something more like this. It would be something more like, so Lord, if we show up and like we startle them and they trip and fall and bust their heads open, that's how I'm going to know this is your will. Basically, Lord, if I just show up and they're already defeated, then I'll know this is what I'm supposed to do. But what Jonathan does is he picks the most expected outcome. I mean, of course, this is what's going to happen. This is what they're going to do. And he picks this most expected outcome to be the sign. It's almost like he picked that so that he could definitely go and charge against this garrison of Philistines. It's kind of like me praying, Lord, if I drive by today where McDonald's was located yesterday and it's still there, that's your sign that I'm supposed to go in and get two Big Macs, a medium fry, and a medium Coke. That's the kind of thing he's doing here. He's not praying for the least possible thing as the sign. He's praying for the most possible thing as the sign. So if you ask me, this is also revealing a little bit about where the Philistines were. If they get up there on this pass and they holler down, you know, hey, look, it's us, check us out. And these guys say, stay right there, we're going to come up there and kill you guys. What does that tell you? That tells you that the Philistines have no fear of the Israelites. Because they don't know if there's 300,000 Israelites behind the mountain range, right? They don't know if there's a booby trap up there. That tells you they have absolutely no concern about Israel's military strength or any military strategy they might have. But for the Philistines to say, bring it on, come down here and fight us, what that's showing is a little bit, I believe, of trepidation. They're saying, okay, we're not going to get lulled into moving out of our strategic location to where there may be risk. We're going to stay put. We're going to let them come to us so that we can see them, so that we can know there's no trap here. There's no massive army hiding behind the mountain range. So it really is kind of the sign, I think, is built around whether or not the Philistines have a little bit of fear for the nation of Israel or not. And the truth is, they do. Verse 11. So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines, stuck their tongues out, blew raspberries. And the Philistines said, look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden themselves. Aren't they cute? Just like two little baby groundhogs coming out to see if they see their shadows. Verse 12. And the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, come up to us and we will show you a thing or two or three. As my generation would put it, they're saying, bring it on. As this younger modern generation would say, go ahead and pull up. I had to explain to Maggie what that meant. Go ahead and pull up. That means, good, pull up to the house. Start some trouble. I'm ready. A little bit more in tune with the kids these days than Maggie is. That's definitely not true. So yeah, they say, bring it on. We're ready for this battle. And that was the sign that Jonathan and his armor bearer were waiting for. So Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come up after me, for the Lord has given them into the hand of Israel. 13. Then Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet, and his armor bearer after him. And they, this garrison of Philistine soldiers, fell before Jonathan and his armor bearer, killed them after him. So did you catch what was happening there? Jonathan is running through this Philistine garrison, just hacking his way as he goes, cutting the Philistines down. And then his armor bearer is following up behind him and finishing them off as they drop. So his armor bearer is batting cleanup here. You know, he's taking them down and the armor bearer is killing them. This was very well coordinated. Incredible stuff. Stuff that you only see in Hollywood movies. And apart from that, if something like this is going to happen, it has got to be God. No one else could do that, right? Chuck Norris, maybe? Chuck Norris and the Sun once had a stare-off. He won, you know. When Chuck Norris doesn't do push-ups, he does earth downs. I got a lot of them, but I'll stop right there. No, that's Hollywood produced. Yeah, these kind of things happen in Hollywood, but outside of Hollywood, if something like this is going to happen, it's just two guys going through and slashing their way through the enemy, dropping the enemy, killing every one of them. It is no doubt a God thing. Very similar to the story, the stories of Samson in the book of Judges, right? This is the kind of thing that he would do. Samson would walk into a crowd of Philistines, grab the nearest thing to him, and then just slash and kill a bunch of Philistines. One guy taking down a crowd of Philistines, and we were told that that was because the Holy Spirit was upon Samson. And that's the same kind of thing that's happening here. No doubt about it, the Holy Spirit is upon Jonathan and his armor bearer because of their faith. Verse 14, and that first strike which Jonathan and his armor bearer made killed about 20 men. So yeah, it wasn't like they killed 1,000 people or anything like that. But still, it's two guys taking on 20 men and killing them all. That is pretty amazing. And then it says, killed about 20 men within, as it were, half a furrow's length in an acre of land. Tricky statement, but basically a furrow is a trench that is made in the soil by a farm plow. And it's always a straight line, right? So what this is saying is that this attack, it happened on 1 acre of land, but it only lasted for half of that acre. So if I would just put this in a statement, I would put it like this. The Jonathan and his armor bearer plowed their way through the Philistines in a straight line over the course of a half an acre of land. So again, it's just something you'd see in a movie. And apart from that, it's an incredible God thing. And for the Lord to give us this much detail on this battle and this victory, that reminds us of one of the Bible's consistent truths, that God is tremendously blessed by great human faith. It is one of two things that will cause God to marvel. You know what the other one is, right? It's a total lack of faith when a person should have faith. That was taught to us through the person of Jesus coming to the earth in flesh, but bearing the image, the characteristic, the nature, the heart of God. And Jesus would marvel at two different things. He would marvel at the people who had every reason to have faith in God, but didn't. He would marvel at that in a negative way. But then he would also marvel at the people who really had no reason to have faith in God, but they did, and they had great faith in God. That would cause Jesus to marvel. And this is the Lord here. I think he just loves this story. It's why he's so detailed about it. This was a wonderful story of tremendous faith. Verse 15. And there was a panic in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. What people would that be? The Philistine people. The garrison, and even the raiders trembled. The earth quaked, and it became a very great panic. So this garrison, the rest of the army of the Philistines, this garrison that is spoken of here, they are shaking in fear. The raiders who were sent out to raid nearby towns for supplies, for food and supplies for the army, they were shaking in fear. And even the earth, it says, got into the act and started shaking. So yes, the Lord, the earth quakes at the presence of the Lord. Job said in Job chapter 9, verse 6, that the Lord shakes the earth out of its place and its pillars tremble. But then David said in Psalm 104:32 that the Lord just looks on the earth and it trembles. It's like, uh-oh, he's looking down here. What's he going to do? Uh-oh. Is he going to move some mountains out of the way? So this is starting to sound like an Elvis cover of a Jerry Lee Lewis song. There's a whole lot of shaking going on. God has shown up for Jonathan. Verse 16, and the watchmen of Saul in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude was dispersing. And that is the Hebrew word moog. This is one of the best Hebrew words ever. It's just awesome. Moog. And moog means to melt. So the Philistine army is mooging. They're melting. They are dispersing, it says here and there. So what are they doing? They're scattering seven ways. They came in one way through the pass of Michmash, but just as the Lord promised, they're scattering in a whole bunch of different directions. Jonathan and his armor bearer only took on a small garrison, but that has panicked the rest of the Philistine army. They think something much bigger is taking place. They're completely confused, so they run for their lives. So it just reminds us, what are we worried about? If God be for us, who can be against us? God can deliver just as well if it's just you and him, or if it's you and him and the whole church. Numbers don't matter. When God determines to deliver, he will deliver. When God determines to answer, he will answer. When God determines to do, he will do. The problem is never going to be that our enemy is too big. The problem is always that our faith is too small, that we make God too small in our estimation because of something else that we've got our attention on. So let's fix that. I think the Holy Spirit would say to us tonight, oh, you of little faith, read the word to build your faith. Become a man or a woman of great faith through intention, through prayer, and through study of the word. Verse 17. Then Saul said to the people who were with him, count and see who has gone from us. So we were told in verse 3, remember, that no one noticed Jonathan and his armor bearer slip away. They don't know those two are gone. So they have no idea what's happening here. They just see the Philistines running for their lives. The army's breaking up and bolting, and they're figuring, well, it's got to be our guys, right? What is there like? Did the army show up? You know, is there like... Is there 10 or 20 guys missing from here? It's got to be a group of us that's caused this, right? So they're going to take a roll call to see who's missing. And when they had counted, behold, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. And they were probably even more confused at this point, right? Because two guys couldn't have done that, right? Two guys, for sure, could not have chased off the whole Philistine army, could they? That wouldn't make sense. At all. All right, well, let's take a look. Verse 18, so Saul said to Ahijah, the priest, bring the ark of God here. For the ark of God went at that time with the people of Israel. Now, should Saul be doing this? Should he be calling for the ark and have the ark drug out with them in battle? That was against the law of Moses. This would be a trespass against the law of Moses. We saw this sort of thing done before to very ill effect. Do you remember who did it? Eli, the high priest. That was in 1 Samuel chapter 4. It was the same enemy. It was the Israelites versus the Philistines. And Eli felt as though if he had the ark out there, representing God, that I don't know, maybe God was in the box. You remember that study? Maybe God's in the box. If we get the box out there, we'll win. Maybe it's like a good luck charm, and we can, like a rabbit's foot, haul it out there and we'll have good luck in battle. So that is not the best model for Saul to use here. You remember how that ended, don't you? It ended with Israel losing the battle. It ended with Eli losing both of his sons, Hophni and Phinehas. And worse yet, it ended with the nation of Israel losing the Ark of the Covenant to the Philistines. So don't use that as an example to follow, Saul. But Saul is Saul. Knuckleheads are going to be knuckleheads. He's going to do what he's going to do. He says, go fetch the Ark, bring it out here, and let's hope it brings us luck. Hopefully we can finish this battle off and win this war forever. Verse 19. Now while Saul was talking to the priest, so he's just now in the process of telling the priest, hey, go get the Ark and bring the Ark of the Covenant, drag it out here with us to battle. He's just now telling the priest to do that. And then it says, the tumult in the camp of the Philistines increased more and more. So Saul said to the priest, withdraw your hand. What he means is, never mind for a sec. Don't worry about the Ark. I don't think we're going to need it. I think we got him whooped. I think we've got him routed. Just hang tight for a minute. Let's see what happens here. Verse 20. Then Saul and all the people who were with him rallied and went into the battle. So, you know, these are the folks that show up after the work is done and say, hey, can I help? They're like, oh, the enemy's on the run. Yes, of course, I would like to join the army. I would like to chase me some Philistines. Let's do this. Maybe you know some folks like that. They wait till they know you're done with whatever it is that's labor intensive, and then there they are. Hey, you need anything? It says, and behold, every Philistine's sword was against his fellow. They turned the swords on one another. And there was very great confusion. The Philistines were discombobulated. I always look for opportunities to use that word in my teachings. I love that word. The Philistines were completely discombobulated by all of this. And this was not the first time, nor will it be the last time, that something just like this happens in the Bible, where the enemies of God's people end up getting so confused or frightful that they turn swords against each other and end up taking each other out. The same thing happened in Judges chapter 7, verse 22, and that was the story of Gideon. It was dark of night. Gideon had them stick the torches in the clay pots and then blow the trumpet and then smash the clay pots. So you have the sound of the trumpet, which was, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da, charge! And then you hear this loud commotion all around you, surrounding you. And then you see the reflection of that light from all of those broken pieces of pottery. And it looked like a whole multitude, a whole entire massive army was up around you, surrounding you, ready to pounce on you. So they freaked out. They did the same thing. Out of fear and confusion, they ended up turning the swords against one another and killing one another. The same thing would happen later on in 2 Chronicles, chapter 20, verses 22 and 3, under King Jehoshaphat against the Moabites. The people had just decided to have a worship session, you know. They started worshiping. And their worship, man, they must have been like really bad. It must have sounded like dying cats. Their worship completely confused the enemy, the Moabites, filled them with fear, and they did the same thing. They just ended up turning the swords against one another and taking each other out. They destroyed themselves. A somewhat similar thing happened in 2 Kings chapter 7, verses 6 and 7, where God was playing with the ears of the enemy invaders, the Syrians. And he caused them to hear a sound like a mighty multitude, a great army charging against them. They all heard this and they just thought, well, Israel must have made some allies. They must have called in reinforcements. We got to get out of here. And they did. They split. So all of those very similar stories to what we're seeing in First Samuel chapter 14. We're just always so worried about our enemies. But our warfare isn't even carnal. As Christians, we're not fighting flesh and blood. We're not engaged in these armies. God is fighting for us. God is routing our enemies. He's confusing them. He's discombobulating them. He's misleading them and misdirecting them. He's turning them on themselves so that they're destroying themselves. He's fighting our battles for us. We just have to make sure that that's where our faith stays. And we have to make sure that we don't fall into the trap of letting the course of that get reversed and allowing our enemy, Satan, to confuse and frighten us so that we get out our swords, the sword of the Spirit, and start hacking at each other in our confusion and in our fear. And we take out the scriptures and we just start beating each other with them and swinging the sword of the Spirit, trying to hurt each other. You moron, it's not a post-trib. You moron, it's not a mid-trib, it's a pre-trib. We do that. We got to be careful. The enemy would love to turn that strategy right back on God and have us infighting and have us destroying ourselves and swinging and hacking and slicing at one another. Verse 21, let's finish this up quickly. Now the Hebrews, who had been with the Philistines before that time and who had gone up with them into the camp, even they also turned to be with the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. So there were pockets of the nation of Israel that the Philistines had just successfully subjugated. And so many of those Jews were servants and slaves to the Philistines, even to the point where these Jews would just kind of turn and become a part of the Philistine nation. That's what you're seeing here. You're seeing folks that were subjugated, they were oppressed, they were basically just resolved to live as a Philistine among the Philistines. But when they see the Philistine army running, now their faith gets bolstered. Now their courage gets bolstered and they join in the fray here to help the nation of Israel and their soldiers fighting against these Philistines. They're going for their freedom now. They see a window of opportunity. Verse 22. Likewise, when all the men of Israel who had hidden themselves in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines were fleeing, they too followed hard after them in the battle. So you remember those soldiers, the ones that chickened out when Jonathan first poked the bear and the Philistines were mustering, the folks that ran away and hid in caves and tombs and cisterns. Well, their faith is now back. Their courage is now back. And all it took for all of this inspiration, for all of these people, all of these soldiers to get their courage and their faith back, all it took was two men with great faith stepping out on that faith. So everyone else now in this story is catching Jonathan's faith. His faith is snowballing throughout the whole nation. And that is how faith is supposed to be. Faith is supposed to be shed. Faith is supposed to be contagious. It's one of the many reasons why church attendance is so important. In Hebrews chapter 10, verses 19 through 25, as the writer of Hebrews is talking about those things, faith, our confidence in God, our hope, as he's talking about those things, he then turns to show us how we can leverage that to edify other believers. And this is what he says, Hebrews 10, 22 through 25. Let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith, with our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering. For he who promised is faithful, and let us consider how to stir up one another to love and good works. And here it is, not neglecting to meet together as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. So that's the verse, you know, he uses that verse to say, here's how you can build up the faith of other people. Get your carcass in church and get there regularly. God can use you to bless them and edify them. So I am very thankful tonight that faith is contagious. I've been around a lot of people that had contagious faith, and I caught it. I've been catching that faith for many, many decades now from many, many different people. I love that faith is contagious. That's good for us, but we do have to be careful because there's a lot of other stuff that is contagious. COVID, of course. But fear is contagious. Doubt is contagious. a critical spirit, being critical in the church, that's contagious. Judgmentalism, that's contagious. Complaining, that's contagious too. So, you gotta know what it is that you want to catch. And you gotta get around people that have what you're wanting to catch. Like if you want the flu, grab someone that has the flu, hug them, kiss them a bunch. You're gonna get the flu. If you want great faith, get yourself around people that have great faith. Get yourself around people that you would be quite glad to be more like in life. Let's stand and let's close in a word of prayer.